Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, time is running out to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. If you've already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year, thank you. You make it possible for us to do this very important work, to bring human-centered coverage from all around the globe to your ears every single weekday, to bring you stories straight from lived experience from the people who are impacted the most, and to broaden your horizons and keep you connected to the world beyond our borders. If you have not given yet, this is your chance. By making a gift, you're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
As Omicron rages, governments are employing an array of strategies. One extreme, the Netherlands now face holiday restrictions.
It's 2 guests per household until mid-January, 4 guests around Christmas and New Year's.
We'll compare that to other national approaches. Also today, a Chinese tennis star speaks up. Peng Shuai now says she was never sexually assaulted.
It comes off as highly staged. It's not exactly a reassurance that everything is fine, is it?
I'm Marco Werman, and 2 years ago when COVID broke out, a California family found themselves stuck near Shanghai. When they tried to return to the U.S., they couldn't get visas, so they stayed.
Yeah, my God, you have to be strong, right? And, you know, we have to be tough.
Stoic during the pandemic, those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. We begin the week talking about that Greek letter on everybody's mind, Omicron. The highly transmissible variant is driving new surges of COVID across the globe. But the way different nations have responded to Omicron have been across the board. To help make sense of what's going on, we turn now to Gavin Yamy. He's a professor of global health at Duke University. So, Gavin, first I want to understand some of the current responses as cases surge around the globe. Let's start in the UK, which has been a real hotspot of Omicron for a couple of weeks. It's also a place where you have strong personal and professional ties. As a global health researcher, though, what stands out to you about the situation in the UK and what worries you?
So, Marco, as you said, cases are really skyrocketing in the United Kingdom. As you said, Omicron is highly transmissible. It is coming at us extraordinarily quickly. It's important to note that in the United Kingdom, they've done extremely well on vaccination. Around 90% of over 12-year-olds have had at least one dose. And it does appear, keep fingers and toes crossed, that the vaccinations have decoupled cases and hospitalization. Massive rise in cases, but so far only a very slow rise in hospitalizations. Though, of course, we don't know whether that decoupling will continue. They've done amazingly on boosters as well. The big question, of course, in the UK is whether or not Boris Johnson is going to impose new measures. The new measure under consideration is called a circuit breaker, a 2-week circuit breaker, where you restrict indoor mixing. And it looks like that's not going to happen, or at least if it does happen, it certainly won't be until after Christmas.
So, new cases growing every day in the UK. Are you seeing any different public health approach to Omicron than what the UK has done for the past 20 months or so? And what do you think about Boris Johnson's scheme so far?
I would say that probably in Europe, the country that has introduced the strictest measures is the Netherlands. They did announce a circuit breaker, which means that mixing is limited. It's 2 guests per household until mid-January, 4 guests around Christmas and New Year's Eve, and closure of non-essential shops. The Prime Minister there, Mark Rutte, has said that if they don't do this, there is going to be what he called an unmanageable situation in hospitals. Now, look, Marco, this is the issue, that hospitals are already at enormous strain, right? There just isn't a lot of slack in the system. And the big concern is that health systems are going to be under enormous pressure and, you know, God forbid, even collapse. What we are seeing is increasing numbers of infections in health workers themselves. I have friends in London who are doctors. You know, many are infected. There's a lot of health workers who are isolating now. And don't forget, hospitals are already dealing with backlogs, right, of postponed surgeries and other treatments. And so if you've then got staff off work and you start to see the rise in hospitalizations from COVID, that really is a perfect storm. So I can understand the Netherlands approach. You know, the discussions about circuit breakers are always incredibly fraught.
I know you and others have been calling for a vaccine plus strategy. Explain what that is and how does it relate to like the draconian measures taken by the Dutch government?
So it's vaccines plus the other science-based, evidence-based public health measures that we know can control transmission. It's really important to do whatever we can to control transmission today. And that includes things like high filtration masks, you know, rapid testing, ventilation, reducing the amount of social mixing. You know, I was in England not that long ago, and you can walk into any pharmacy and get two boxes of free rapid tests. That's 14 tests in total. Mm-hmm. I came back to the United States. It's literally impossible to buy a rapid test where I live in Durham, North Carolina. Why isn't the US government, for example, you know, making rapid tests freely available and in huge supply? I mean, why isn't it mailing them to people as they do in the United Kingdom? Why isn't the US government mailing high filtration, you know, proper masks to everyone in the United States? You know, there are all these measures that we know work, and we need to be adopting an all-of-the-above approach right now.
So shifting continents, Gavin, to South Africa, one of the first places where Omicron was identified, many are hoping the massive surge there won't translate to more illnesses and deaths. And so far, it appears that it has not. But there's still a lot we don't know about Omicron. What are you learning from colleagues there about the impact of this variant, especially given that South Africa already had very high exposure rates before Omicron hit?
Yes, that's right, Marco. So it does appear that the peak is over, certainly in Gauteng province, where Johannesburg and Pretoria are. And it has been publicly reported, and there's much focus and much discussion in which the people who have been infected with Omicron appear to be less likely to have been hospitalized. And so it could be that it was a younger age group. It could be that there's just a lag between cases and hospitalizations and deaths, you know, a time lag, and that that hasn't showed up. And then, as you said, the other consideration is that South Africa did have three very massive COVID surges, and a very large percentage of the population were infected. So it could be that past exposure and past infection and survival explains what appears to be a less severe illness. Having said all that, that, of course, has come at a cost. My heart always sinks, my stomach always turns whenever I see anyone say, well, it's good news that South Africa had so much infection in the past. You know, I find that incredibly troubling and disturbing, because it also means that there were a lot of deaths, you know, and it also means there's a lot of people with long-term symptoms, so-called long COVID. So that's not a strategy, obviously, for ending the pandemic. With this new variant, there is still uncertainty. I think that's just a really important message, that there's a lot we still don't know, including the true severity of the variant.
Finally, the hope has always been that COVID might turn into something more like the seasonal flu, less virulent. So what could it mean for the world if Omicron continues to spread as it is right now?
So I think that's the end game. The end game is that we turn COVID-19 into an illness that is more akin to a cold. that it doesn't cause these waves and it doesn't cause waves of hospitalizations and deaths. We are not going to eradicate this virus, SARS-CoV-2, but we absolutely can prevent it from causing, you know, these sorts of waves. And certainly we want to end these waves of hospitalizations and deaths. We're going to have better and better treatments. We're going to have, you know, newer vaccines. We're going to have a range of science-based tools. But for us to get there, we are going to have to do one thing that I would argue is the defining global health and development challenge of our time, and one that we are failing. And that is, we are going to have to vaccinate the world. We're going to have to vaccinate the vast majority of the world. And right now, if you look at low-income countries, only about 7% of people in low-income countries have had even their first dose, you know, let alone a booster. So that has to become the number one priority for the international health and development community. It's absolutely true that no one is safe until we are all safe. And that's the way in which we end the pandemic.
Dr. Gavin Yamy, Professor of Global Health at Duke University, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Marco.
It's hard to believe that it's been 2 years now since the novel coronavirus first appeared in Wuhan, China. Not long after, we reported on a California family that traveled to China, then couldn't return home.
We stay here. We're just stuck here.
That's Elizabeth's son, who was hunkered down in China with her husband and two kids. The World's Monica Campbell has this update.
When I first spoke with the family, COVID-19 was hitting hard in China, and they were stuck in their apartment. The kids, little Liam and Francine, passed time sitting on their bed making videos of themselves saying tongue twisters in English and Mandarin.
How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
They sang songs from the video game Minecraft.
Yeah, through the night, they all fear me.
The family went to China in January of 2020 to renew the parents' U.S. work visas. But as the pandemic spread, embassies and consular offices shut down, and travel restrictions were put in place. And they allege the entire trip could have been avoided if their attorney hadn't made a paperwork mistake with their case. Their attorney's firm, BAL, which is based in Dallas, didn't respond to an interview request. Elizabeth's son, the kid's mom, says it was all so abrupt.
You know, life suddenly changed, and nobody can expect this.
They're still in China nearly 2 years on. It's hard to know for sure, but they're likely joined by thousands of others in binds like this, out in orbit because of the pandemic and a complicated U.S. immigration system. When we catch up over Skype this month, they're all home in their apartment near Shanghai. Francine is now 12, and Liam...
I'm 8 years old. I'm in grade 2.
They tried remote schooling, connecting with their classrooms near San Francisco from China. That lasted about 6 months. It was a struggle with the time zone differences. Now the kids are in school in China. Elizabeth says it's been a big adjustment.
In China, they kind of have the pressure in the test. There's all kinds of tests.
Elizabeth found a job teaching English and environmental management at her kids' school. Before, she was a university professor in San Francisco. It's a switch, but she likes her new job and the students.
They want to know more about American culture. I taught them English. We really have a pretty tight connection there. And
At first, Elizabeth's husband, Hua, was out of work, but he got a software engineering job offer from Amazon and is now working across time zones with a team in Seattle.
I have to wake up very early. It's not easy to remotely working from China for a U.S. team.
I was joking around. I said, oh, you are like a candle, like burning two ends.
While they fight to get back to the U.S., they're making the most of life in China. Elizabeth gives me a video tour of their apartment.
We have this balcony here.
They're 13 floors up with a view of other high-rises.
The view is pretty good, actually.
There's a lake nearby that they like to jog around. Liam has piano lessons on Sundays.
We always encourage each other as a family.
Elizabeth remembers the friendship bracelets her daughter Francine braided for the family during their first few months in China. There's a picture of them all wearing them, holding hands.
Yeah, my God, you have to be strong, right? And, you know, sometimes I feel like very depressed. How can my kids to be happy? So it's, you know, we have to be tough.
It's the most they can do, as they hope this long journey ends with them back in California by this time next year. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Chile, the votes have been tallied from yesterday's presidential election, and it's Gabriel Boric in a landslide. The left-of-center former student protest leader is only 35 years old. Here's The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia.
Buenas noches, Chile!
Gabriel Boric spoke before an electrified crowd in Santiago. He greeted them in Spanish and then in the language of the most populous indigenous community in the south, Mapuche.
Bonui, suma aruma, pun mai, Chile.
Boric stunned his opponent, the extreme right former lawmaker, José Antonio Kast, defeating him last night by almost 12 percentage points. And Boric's list of thank yous gave an indication of who carried him to victory.
Quiero agradecer a las mujeres de nuestra patria.
Boric started out by thanking women. He's promised to make advances on issues of gender equality, including loosening Chile's strict abortion rules.
También a las disidencias y diversidades que han sido largamente.
With rainbow flags flowing above the crowd, Boric also thanked dissidents and minority groups. He's promised to improve inclusiveness for LGBTQ people.
Y que nunca, por ningún motivo, podemos volver a tener un presidente que le declare la guerra a su propio pueblo.
Boric made a reference to Augusto Pinochet's 17-year dictatorship, saying Chile can never again have a president who declares war on his own people.
Wow, I'm being really honest, I'm still processing what just happened yesterday.
Manuela Badilla is a sociologist at the Universidad de Valparaíso. She was at Boric's speech last night.
Seeing him getting to the state, it was amazing, very touching, because in a way we have been seeing him growing up with all of us.
Boric came into politics more than a decade ago as a student protest leader. He was later elected to Congress. In this campaign, he won over many young voters who 2 years ago marched against the government's economic policies, which many see as a legacy of the dictatorship. Badilla says she was fearful of Boric's opponent, José Antonio Kast, winning the election because he espoused some Pinochet-era ideologies.
Yeah, because he represents many difficult things for women, especially, you know, the possibility of going backward.
For example, Badilla says, under Kast, Chile's relatively recent legalization of abortion would have been in jeopardy. The same goes for a process the country is undergoing to rewrite the constitution, which Kast opposed. Gilberto Aranda is a professor at the Universidad de Chile.
Bueno, me parece que es una votación histórica. No,
Boric's victory is historic, Aranda says. He received more votes than any presidential candidate in the history of Chile, a country of 19 million people. He even received more votes than the referendum that ended the dictatorship in 1988.
Sin embargo, yo diría que este 44%.
However, Aranda says, the 44% who voted for Boric's opponent cannot be ignored. Working with conservatives will be one of Boric's biggest challenges. In fact, Gabriel Boric might have more in common instead with the left-leaning presidents of Chile's neighbors, Argentina, Bolivia, and Peru.
Es posible que esta elección marque eventualmente el arribo de una nueva izquierda.
It's possible that this election could eventually represent the arrival of a new left to Latin America, Aranda says. One that opposes autocratic regimes like those of Venezuela and Nicaragua and promotes social, economic, and environmental justice. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai has retracted her claim of sexual assault. In what's thought to be her first media interview since alleging a former top official in the Chinese Communist Party had coerced her into having a sexual relationship, Peng said yesterday, "I have never claimed or written that anyone sexually assaulted me. This point must be emphasized very clearly." That's from an 8-minute video interview Peng conducted with the Singapore-based Chinese language newspaper Lianhe Zaobao on Sunday. Among those questioning whether Peng's denial can be taken at face value is Jeremy Goldcorn. He's editor-in-chief of SubChina and founder of the Seneca podcast. What went through your mind, Jeremy, when you heard this interview with Peng Shuai denying that she had accused a former senior official in the Communist Party of having sexually assaulted her?
The whole thing came off as highly staged. This Lianhe Zaobao reporter just happened to be in some place where there happened to be Yao Ming, you know, the most famous Chinese sports person on the planet, the giant basketball player. He happened to be with Peng Shuai, who happens to be in the news. And they just were fine with this random reporter, you know, doorstepping them with a mobile phone. So, you know, when you watch the video, it comes off as highly staged. So it's not exactly a reassurance that everything is fine, is it?
Jeremy, how unusual is it in China for someone who levels an accusation against a top official to then backpedal? Have you seen this kind of flipping before, if that is what it is?
None of this really would have been possible before social media. So I don't recall any kind of similar case like this. There have been many, many cases of people who've got into trouble with the government and then have been forced into television appearances where they say that everything is fine and, you know, there's no problem and, you know, whatever had happened was a misunderstanding.
Do you have an example of that?
Yeah, for example, the bookseller Gui Minhai, who's a Swedish citizen but operated a bookstore in Hong Kong, and they published some of them very sort of, I guess you'd call it sort of tabloid journalism, but some of it quite hard-hitting accusations about the misbehavior of senior Chinese government officials. And after him disappearing, he appeared on a video where, you know, he said everything was fine. But this particular combination of, you know, the celebrity, the real genuine, you know, international celebrity of a famous sports star accusing, you know, such a senior government official of sexual harassment on social media. I mean, this is a new, a whole new thing.
So, Jeremy, what do you think is the likeliest scenario or scenarios going on behind the scenes?
Well, I think that she is in a situation where she's not at complete liberty by any means, that there's a lot of pressure on her to reassure the world that she's okay. And if she does that, she will be okay. I believe that she herself probably really would like to be just left alone. Unfortunately, she's stuck right in the middle of a global media storm in some ways that involves the Women's Tennis Association. So it's not something that can be swept under the carpet. And unfortunately, this seems to be one of those issues where the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda officials are so very sensitive and hypersensitive that they're going to continue to produce the Barbara Streisand effect where, you know, this particular video, Peng Shuai was actually kind of fading from the Western news media. But after this particular video, here I am, China's propaganda authorities are so unable to deal with the realities of the international uncensored media that they're going to continue to do this. So despite their best efforts, it's not going to disappear. And they're going to keep on making it worse. But her own name is a censored word on the Chinese internet. So how, you know, I mean, this is the other absurd thing we haven't discussed, actually, is that all of this is going on outside of China. And inside of China, you can't get any information about her at all. You know, the government has a proven track record of being able to use censorship to disappear a subject from the public consciousness. They're very good at it.
Jeremy Goldcorn, the editor-in-chief of SubChina and co-founder of the Seneca podcast. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you, Marco.
We'll be right back with more in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. President Biden's climate change action plan suffers a big blow. Senator Joe Manchin says he can't get behind it. A domestic squabble that could undermine the push for global collective action.
Climate change is sort of the ultimate global tragedy of the commons problem. It doesn't matter where a ton of CO2 emissions come from, so we only get where we need to go if all countries do their part.
Coming up in the next half hour here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. On Sunday, hundreds of thousands of people in Sudan went out to protest the military coup that took place in October. Security forces fired tear gas and stun grenades at demonstrators, One man was shot and killed. The leader of the coup, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, accused protesters of having a, quote, blatantly contentious and hostile tone. In response, many Sudanese point to this fact. At least 45 demonstrators have been killed by the military since the coup. From Sudan's capital, Khartoum, the world's Halima Gikandi reports.
The flag of Sudan flies high above a group of demonstrators here in Bahri, just north of Khartoum. And it's here where Sudanese people once again have gathered to demonstrate against the military and for democracy in Sudan. As I look around, I can see people holding posters and flags depicting the faces of the more than 40 people who protesters say were killed by security forces since the coup in October. And one of those people was Sitt al-Nafur.
Sitt al-Nafur Ahmed was a young woman from Bahri who was shot dead last month at a demonstration. I meet Nashwa Abdulaziz, a 22-year-old business student here. She's wearing a picture of Ahmed's face on her chest. I ask her why. Ahmed's death really touched me, she says, because this was a martyr of the revolution, killed in pursuit of democracy for Sudan. In the past month, Ahmed's smiling face, draped in a light purple hijab, has been shared everywhere, on posters and on social media. There's even a song about her. I traveled to Ahmed's home in Bahri to learn more about who she was and what happened. Her mother, Zainab al-Sadiq Bakar, tells me that Ahmed was a nurse, only 25 years old. She was also an activist, a volunteer, who was beloved in her community, the type of person who would gather clothes for the poor and who always helped her neighbors. Her mother says her daughter wanted to see democracy in Sudan. She would join the protests and help people who were injured in clashes with security forces. But during a demonstration on November 17th, she was shot in the head and died that same day, along with 14 other people. Ahmed's mother tells me she wishes she could have traded places with her daughter. She says she will never forgive the people who killed her. What she wants is justice for her daughter, Sitt al-Nafur. But justice has been elusive. The military denies using live ammunition against demonstrators, despite video evidence that shows otherwise. The head of the military, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, says there's an investigation into the killings of protesters underway. I visit lawyer Mudathir Mohamed Taha at his office in Khartoum. He's representing the relatives of people killed during Sudan's revolution. He tells me that more than 200 people have been killed since 2019. One of them was his older brother, who died after being shot at a demonstration. Taha tells me that inspired him to help other families seek justice. Until now, there's been no justice for these victims, Taha says, because the court system is slow in Sudan. And it's extra difficult when the alleged perpetrators are people in the security forces and national intelligence. The security forces still have broad immunity from criminal prosecution, Taha tells me. Activists have been trying to get that protection removed for years. This recent coup has also complicated the situation because the military removed the chief justice and attorney general. But Taha, the lawyer, says that won't stop him from pursuing justice for people he sees as martyrs. Back at the demonstration in Bahri, I asked Nashwa Abdulaziz, the student, whether she fears being killed or injured in a demonstration like this. She tells me, yes, there's some fear, but that fear quickly turns into energy. All of the people who have been killed, she tells me, they motivate us to keep going with this revolution. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Khartoum, Sudan.
The year 2021 will be remembered for a lot of things, including a bigger global push than ever to transition from fossil fuels toward cleaner, renewable energy. It's about combating both climate change and energy shortages. It's happening in North America. Just look at the showdown between President Biden and West Virginia's pro-coal Joe Manchin, but also across South America, Asia, and Europe. Countries battling over finite resources and making the transition to renewables. And my next guest, Jason Bordoff, says a switch to wind and solar won't mean the end of messy geopolitics, just a new chapter. Bordoff is a co-founding dean of the Columbia Climate School and was director for energy and climate change on the National Security Council under President Obama. Jason, let's start big picture. I mean, no doubt there will be some fundamental changes in geopolitics as the globe shifts to renewable energy. Some green energy advocates suggest that less reliance on oil will mean less conflict. Others say we'll see an inflection point as consequential as the transition from coal to oil in the early 20th century. What changes do you realistically expect?
Well, first, we are nowhere close to being on track with the kind of goals we need to see in order to deal with the climate crisis. You can imagine an end state post-fossil fuels. We're going to have a multi-decade period where the old geopolitics of oil and gas continues to be prominent. And layered on top of that, we have new geopolitics of clean energy.
Well, we are curious about your focus on geopolitics in this energy transition. Historically, oil-rich countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia have had a lot of power internationally. How do you think a global move away from oil and gas will affect the power those countries wield? And will they compensate for what could be a lessening of that oil muscle?
I think it really depends on the time frame one is looking at. So I think the conventional wisdom is in a world that meets its climate goals, we move off of oil, and countries that have depended for their revenue on oil exports will wane and become less important. I think the question is how we get there and whether these countries might actually see feast before famine to the extent that today the world is not investing enough in energy. We are investing about the right amount in oil and gas, as we should be if we were on track for our net zero goals. The problem is we're not investing nearly enough in clean energy. So one of those two has to change. And if we continue to stay where we should be for oil and gas investment, but don't significantly ramp up clean energy, we risk underinvesting. That risks energy scarcity and market shortages and price spikes. If we see periods where there are energy shortages, you could see the Biden administration or others say to Saudi Arabia, to other members of OPEC, we need more of your oil. Their role putting oil supply in the market and balancing volatility could become more important before it becomes less important.
Meantime, there's new pressure coming from the push for renewable energies. Things like wind turbines and electric vehicles need a large influx of minerals and metals. So a global transition toward renewables is putting those minerals in high demand in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Do you think minerals like cobalt and copper and lithium will become the new oil?
We should be clear that they're different from oil in the sense that they are input to a finished good. They're not the daily flow of energy itself. Nonetheless, the top three oil suppliers in the world today, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Russia, each supply about 10% of world demand. The top supplier of lithium, of rare earth elements, of cobalt, each of those supply more than 50%. So there's much greater concentration that presents more ability for some geopolitical influence if you were threatened to withhold those supplies. China's particularly dominant in the refining and processing of these critical minerals. So energy security comes from not independence. We often use the word independence. It comes from diversity and optionality.
In the U.S. this week, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who has ties to the coal industry there, has said he's not going to vote for President Biden's Build Back Better plan. Without his vote, the bill is dead in the water. The plan contained incentives for the expansion of renewable energy. What do you see as the wider global geopolitical consequences of this bill failing, if that's what happens?
Build Back Better was a centerpiece of the Biden administration's plan for climate change. I think that has implications for the ability of the world to come together and agree to take stronger collective action to meet our climate goals. We only get where we need to go if all countries do their part. And if some countries are seeing the U.S. is not doing their part, I worry that it might undermine their own ambition.
Do you see other countries taking the lead and keep on pushing, or without the U.S. and this bill, does everybody else start backpedaling?
I think some may start to backpedal, but certainly others will see an opportunity. And I think that is something we've seen over the last decade in China in particular, where they have stepped forward to invest significantly and become the dominant supplier of the world's solar panels, of the world's batteries. And they see an opportunity to do that in other forms of clean energy as well. Whether we achieve the net zero goals we need to or fall short of them, we're going to see dramatic growth in clean energy, increasingly just driven by economics. I think they see an economic opportunity to dominate some of these industries, and the U.S. risks missing out on some of those opportunities if we don't invest in a smart way here at home.
Jason Bordoff is a co-founding dean of the Columbia Climate School and was director for energy and climate change on the National Security Council under President Obama. Jason, good to have you on the program. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
In Brazil, a story that shows how real this discussion is, a severe drought is causing huge spikes in electricity prices. Brazil is facing one of its worst water crises in a century. In the southern part of the country, reservoirs that power hydroelectric dams are not even 20% full, forcing Brazil to import power from abroad. Reporter Michael Fox has that story.
Adriana Regina do Nascimento lives in the poor Sao Paulo neighborhood of Itaim Paulista. She has three children. Her youngest, 7-year-old Adriel, has an autoimmune disease and he's autistic, so he doesn't go to school. So when the utility company came to turn off the family's electricity for lack of payment last week, Regina do Nascimento says she fought it.
Na hora, eu mostrei o laudo do meu filho, falei, ó, é isso, tem um acordo, a gente já pagamos dessas seis parcelas, nós já pagamos três.
I told them about my child, she says. I showed them my agreement with the company, how I'm paying the bill in installments. I've already paid off three of them, she says. The power company gave her a break, and the power is still on, but she doesn't know for how long. See, electricity rates have skyrocketed over the last year in Brazil. For Regina do Nascimento, they've more than tripled from the 50 or 60 reais, or roughly $10 a month, her family used to pay. We want to pay the bills, she says, but we're in a situation where we have to prioritize buying food for our family. Her story is becoming increasingly common in poor neighborhoods across Brazil. The Brazilian government says the country's water crisis is behind the spiking electricity rates. In August, Brazil's National Energy Agency hiked some rates over 50%. Energy Minister Bento Albuquerque told Brazilians the country was facing one of the worst droughts in its history.
A escassez de água que atinge nossas hidrelétricas.
He said the lack of water that is impacting Brazil's hydroelectric dams is the worst in 91 years. In Brazil, water is key. Almost 70% of the country's energy is generated by hydroelectric dams like this one, Belo Monte, along the Xingu River in the Brazilian Amazon. It was completed just a couple of years ago, and it's one of the biggest hydroelectric dams in the world. In September, it was running at less than 3% capacity. The same month, massive dust storms hit major cities in the state of Sao Paulo. Videos posted on social media show apocalyptic scenes. A towering wall of dust engulfs the city of Ribeirão Preto into darkness. Experts say rising deforestation and climate change may be in part to blame for the water crisis, and that doesn't bode well for the future. Silvino Nickel is an ecologist at the Federal University of Santa Catarina.
A atual crise hídrica do Brasil é uma consequência.
He says the current water crisis is a consequence not just of what's happening in Brazil, which is an absolute disregard for the environment, but it's the consequence of bad public policies not directed at conserving the environment. The Brazilian government has responded by purchasing 60% more energy from neighboring countries and importing record amounts of natural gas from the United States. It's also relying increasingly on the country's 3,000 thermoelectric power plants. Two-thirds of those run on fossil fuels. Pedro Roberto Jacobi is a professor at the University of Sao Paulo's Energy Institute.
With all the climate change and climate emergency, there has to be more alternative sources of energy. So there has to be an increase in eolic energy, in solar energy.
That's wind and solar energy. But there have been droughts before without electric bills rising sky high. Hydrologist Norbert Fenzi from the Pará State Federal University says the water crisis alone can't account for the rising utility rates.
Isso é uma desculpa
infantil.
That's really a childish excuse, he says. The state-owned company Electrobras is set to be privatized at the beginning of next year. Fenzel thinks the government is increasing prices to bring them closer to market rate. Earlier this year, the energy minister said the privatization would actually help bring down consumer electricity rates. Meanwhile, those in Brazil's low-income communities, like Adriana Regina do Nascimento, are bearing much of the burden for the water crisis and praying for more rain. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
In the Arctic, the indigenous Sami people have a tradition called yoik, a style of singing that captures the spirit of a person, a place, or a thing.
Every place has their own kinds of melodies.
Sara Marielle Beaska is a traditional yoiker. When the Sami people were forced to assimilate into Norwegian culture, the government banned yoiking. Today, Beaska travels around the northern parts of Norway, coming up with new yoiks for fjords, mountains, and springs, including a fjord that's being threatened by pollution from a planned copper mine. She came here to this fjord to find its yoik and protect it.
We need to let the fjord know that we're here and we're going to take care.
But some supporters of the proposed mine say it would take care of the land by helping support renewable energy. We'll be bringing you that part of the story tomorrow here on The World. Some 280 million people in Africa face hunger and malnutrition. That's according to the UN. Experts have attributed this to a rapid increase in food prices, as well as conflict and insecurity, and then the pandemic. In Ghana, an accomplished chef is on a mission to change this narrative using a unique approach that combats food waste along the way. From Ghana's capital, Accra, Ridwan Karim Dini Osman has our story.
Three ladies in white wearing kitchen hairnets and red and wine aprons to march. In front of them, a colorful display of sliced and chopped vegetables and other ingredients. Standing by the stove, one stirs hot palm oil containing salted fish and golden brown onions. At the same time, ginger, garlic, and pepper are being ground into a smooth paste. The meal accompaniment is a mixture of corn and cassava dough. After almost 2 hours, food is ready and the aroma will simply make one salivate. Since 2012, Ghanaian chef Elijah Amoado has been collecting unwanted stock or food likely to go waste from suppliers, farmers and restaurants to feed Ghana's poorest through his NGO, Food for All Africa.
Growing up, my childhood ambition was to become a medical doctor. I lost my parents at the tender age of 12. So after secondary school, without any support, I picked up the passion for cooking.
He had learned to cook from his mother and then as a cleaner at a restaurant. At the age of 21, Amoado was on his way to work at a top restaurant in Ghana's capital, Accra. He came across a mentally challenged man collecting leftover food from a dustbin behind the restaurant. The young chef, out of curiosity, asked what the man was doing.
And his response to me was, "If he doesn't do it, who will?"
It turned out that the man was collecting the food surplus to feed other mentally challenged persons on the streets.
That was where the passion for starting Food for All started from. And then I started supporting orphanages, psychiatric hospital with food.
Ado is now 31 and runs his program full-time, employing more than 30 people. In 2017, he received the Young Leaders Award from Queen Elizabeth II in the United Kingdom for his contribution towards reforming Ghana's food distribution system.
That singular opportunity of receiving an award from a majesty has encouraged and helped in shaping and scaling the work that we currently do at Food for All Africa.
According to the World Food Program, as many as 1.2 million people in Ghana are food insecure, with an additional 2 million people extremely vulnerable. His Food for All Africa team have developed an app intended to make it easier for those who have food to connect with those who are in need. Branded mobile vans carry hundreds of food boxes and bags and hot meals. As I follow the team on its drive to the densely populated community of Ashaiman in Accra, they are met with a large audience of children, women and men scampering for a spot in long queues.
On a daily basis, we support over 8,500 beneficiaries. For our hot meals program, we provide 500 hot meals daily.
Efo Mauli Kafui, a beneficiary, says Food for All has been a blessing.
The food is really delicious. Previously, we could go days without food because I lost my job as a laborer. But this program has been a lifesaver. God bless the man behind it.
But Ado's work is not only well-received in vulnerable communities. Dr. Kojo Asante Pumpuni is with the Ghana Center for Democratic Development.
To do this kind of work, he has a passion for it, and I expect that he will continue to be doing this. It just needs more people to recognize and support him to do what he does best.
Elijah Amo Ado is upbeat his efforts will inspire others.
We will be able in the next few years to create a more sustainable means of nutrition across communities, because issues of hunger must be solved at a community level.
For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
We leave you today 1,000 miles north of Seattle in Fort Nelson, British Columbia, where snow started falling last month. Arlene Schmelick and her husband got out the holiday decorations, colored lights for the bush in the front yard, plus a lawn ornament they bring out every year.
We call him Rudolph the Red-Nosed Whitetail.
A life-size replica of a deer.
But it's not a real deer. It's an archery target.
Because at Christmas time, your usual bow and arrow bullseye target just doesn't cut it.
And when the kids were younger, they said, oh, well, let's put them out in the front yard. So we did. And then my husband put the light bulb on it.
Bringing out the deer with a light-up nose has become an annual ritual in Fort Nelson.
Quite a few people know about them, and it's a joke. Oh, yeah, you got Rudolph the Whitetail out again.
Many people drive by, they look, they laugh, they move on. Other locals react differently. I'm talking about Fort Nelson's deer population.
They come in. They're cautious around other deer, so they're watching. And they walk and they look at them. I've had some deer come up and put nose to nose.
Some other deer have played pretty rough with Rudolph over the years.
My husband has fixed the deer many times. He's glued together so his head doesn't get knocked off or his antlers don't fall out of the little socket.
This year, the Schmelicks installed a doorbell camera that records video. It picks up the whole front yard, including Rudolph, as well as the real deer who comes to visit.
This one came in, looked at it, spooked, and then come around the other way and looked at it and then just charged right at it and knocked it over. He's down. He knocked the legs right off of the archery target.
Rudolph down again. And the Schmelicks caught it all on video. You can see it yourself on our Twitter feed. We're at the world. It's pretty cool for a fake deer. As for Rudolph, the front yard decoration?
He's pretty resilient. I managed to put his legs back on and he's standing proud again.
Arlene Schmelick of Fort Nelson, British Columbia, told her story to our colleagues at CBC Radio's Daybreak North. Only four more nights until the real Rudolph takes to the skies, and by then the days also grow longer. It's all good. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you tomorrow.